The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi, my name is Danny Roth, and this is Everyday Horror. It's a podcast where we watch at least one horror movie for every day in the month of October. And then we talk about it. Today, I am joined by Ben Schur, who is the producer on AMC Visionary's Eli Roth's History of Horror. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I am very happy to have you. I will talk to anybody that loves horror movies. And if you're producing a horror-related thing, it seems like a lock. Seems like a thing that would be true. What movie did you pick for us to watch?
Poltergeist 2, The Other Side.
I'm glad that you used the full title. It's very important. Very important. I always do that with Gremlins 2, The New Batch.
Yes.
Because if you just say Gremlins 2, you're really missing out. Like, Gremlins 2, The New Batch is, like, to me, one of the best sequel titles of all time. And one of the best sequels ever made. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about Poltergeist 2. Do you remember when you saw it for the first time?
I do. This was the first horror movie that I ever saw, period. And it began a lifelong obsession. And I ended up seeing it purely by coincidence. I had been kind of having that classic story where you're looking at the boxes at the video store and they're so amazing. And at my video store, there was a poster for a movie called Waxwork that entranced me. And I was like, you know what? I'm brave enough. I'm finally going to do this. I need to see this movie so badly. I'm going to rent it. So I asked to rent it. Waxwork was checked out. So my mom said to the video store clerk, well, what's a movie that he can watch? And he said, Poltergeist 2. And I'm guessing that that's because he thought, well, this movie wouldn't scare anybody, so I'm not going to get in trouble with the mom. And I insisted on seeing the cover. And then I was like, oh, yeah, that's the one with the girl on the phone. I got to see that. So I brought it over to a friend's house. We watched it. And It didn't scare me, and that was the most exciting thing, because I thought that horror movies would just be too terrifying, and it wasn't. It just kind of filled me with joy and wonder and excitement. I was a little scared that night, you know, when I tried to go to sleep. I saw faces and images, but I was just enthralled by it, and I wanted to see every horror movie ever made, and I'm glad that I saw that first instead of Waxwork, because I later rented Waxwork, and it kind of sucked. So my whole life might have been different.
How could you come for Waxwork in this way?
I like it now,
cold-blooded.
But when I was a kid, it was kind of boring. I don't know.
I guess, that's a podcast for another day, but I like it as an adult. They re-released it along with the sequel through that Lionsgate Vestron Video sort of reboot kind of thing on Blu-ray about a year or so ago, and maybe it's by virtue of having them both side by side, but Waxwork seems pretty good when compared with Waxwork 2.
No, I got that Blu-ray, and it is true. The transfer is so gorgeous, and it really, you could appreciate it. And anything with Jack Galligan and Deborah Foreman, you know, I'll love at least somewhat.
Yeah, for sure. Interestingly, I was terrified of Poltergeist 2. It was the first one that didn't scare me. I mean, that feeling of wonder that you were talking about, I got off of the first one. But the second one had a very specific scene that has led to a lifetime of problems, and it is the braces scene.
Oh, yeah.
I swear this is true. I saw the movie, and I mean, timelines for kids are kind of unpredictable, but it couldn't have been that long after that I had to go to the dentist, and they said, oh, you got to get braces. And I said, nope, that will not be happening. So I wound up getting this really weird retainer instead that only took care of like one part of the problem. And so if you ever meet me and you think, boy, that guy's got some real crowding down on the bottom layer of his teeth, it's because of Poltergeist too.
Is it really? Is that really the reason you refused to get braces? Because you were afraid that they would come to life and entrap you?
100%. I absolutely believed that. I was terrified. I don't know why. I don't know what my damage was or is. I mean, we literally mentioned right before the podcast started that I haven't been to a dentist in 10 years. Also, I would say probably in part because of Poltergeist 2. Just really messed me right up on the whole teeth situation.
I was reading some background on Poltergeist 2, and I was reading an analysis of the sound designer and how they achieved the sounds in the braces scene. And one thing that they did, they took wires and actually like pulled them through teeth, but they also ran a dentist's drill. They said to hit people in the subconscious. So maybe it affected you even more than you realize.
Oh yeah, I believe it. Yes, that 100% tracks for me. But just very sort of very quickly, because this is a sequel, I feel like we should sort of set up Poltergeist, because, you know, there may be some millennials out there or whatever is the one directly underneath, and maybe they don't know about Poltergeist, which is actually, I think, in my top five favorite horror movies. But the pitch is family lives in a cookie cutter suburban house that looks like every other house around it. And it turns out, unbeknownst to them, that their house is built over some kind of burial ground. And as a result, the house gets kind of possessed. And the women in the family, especially the youngest child, Carol Ann, seem to have some kind of psychic connection to this sort of afterworld. And so Carol Ann gets captured, and then they have to sort of go on this process of figuring out what's happened and get her back. And, you know, there's all this stuff where, like, they're talking through the television and there's stakes crawling along the ground and people ripping their faces apart, or are they? And then Zelda Rubinstein shows up and saves the day, or does she? And it's just, I think very rarely do you get to say something feels like a horror movie for the whole family, but that always felt like the one to me. And it was hugely, hugely famous, and was the reason why PG-13 exists to an extent. And it's one of those movies where it's like, who really made it? Because it's because Spielberg, I think, wanted to do it, was the deal, but he couldn't because he was also doing E.T. and he couldn't do them both because there are rules. And so they brought in Mr. Texas Chainsaw Massacre himself to do it. And yeah, and there's always been this sort of conversation over who filmed what, who filmed the most between Tobe Hooper or Steven Spielberg. And it really depends on which actors you ask. And there's all this sort of weird stuff. But I think most of it, and just based on what I've seen of Tobe Hooper's filmmaking, I really do think most of it is him. I just think that the movie opens on a very Spielbergian shot of the bicycle with the little remote control mini cars and stuff. Like, all of that is very Spielberg. So it, because that opening moment is, I believe, was shot by him. Everybody starts to think of the rest of the movie as being a Spielberg joint, even though the rest of it, I think, is demonstrably Tobe Hooper's.
Yeah, I think that I completely agree with you. I think that Tobe Hooper was very much the director, and I'm sure Steven Spielberg was an interactive producer. But that's a great point about that opening shot having an excessive influence. And also the setting. I mean, it looks like the houses in E.T. But the movie definitely has a marked intensity and surreality. I don't know what the word is. That feels very Hooper-like to me.
Yeah, and then there is the thing that I think, if we're talking about things that sort of carry over from the first to the sequel, there is the curse, right? This is like the big thing about Poltergeist is that in addition to who really directed it, the other conversation is, was the film cursed? Were there really dead bodies there? Where, you know, like, where did they film? What, like, why did all of these weird things supposedly happen? And that is, to me, super interesting. That's one of those things that always stayed with me. Because, like, by virtue of watching it, you almost feel like you're kind of part of the whole You feel like you're cursed yourself, especially when you're a kid.
Yeah, especially because the whole first movie is about the TV, you know, have it possessing you. And then you hear about all of these tragic deaths surrounding the film. Yeah, I wasn't aware of the Poltergeist curse until I was older. So I was probably too old to get that extra element of creepiness. But it's something. And I think it's funny that apparently I was reading some press interview at the time that, and Joe Beth Williams and Craig T. Nelson said, the house in Poltergeist 2, they found out was built over a Native American burial ground. And I was like, are you kidding? After all the first one's drama, they would do that? I don't know if I buy it. I think about it for the press.
That feels phony. But yeah, I mean, like, that's sort of a weird, like, yeah, what is the deal there? But yeah, like the big, sort of like the big fallout of that specifically was that, you know, they had to make a decision because Dominic Dunn, who played the sister, Dana Freeling, or Freeling, good grief, had died like shortly thereafter. So they had to say, are we going to include her in some way or not? And I guess originally at some point they were going to say she was away at school, and instead they just kind of decided to say nothing.
Which, I don't know. I mean, none of it really works.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think, I don't know. It came out a couple years later. She wasn't that big a part of the first movie, honestly. What I remember about her was the middle finger to the construction guys, and at the end she comes back as the house is like reaching peak possession with the coffins exploding out of the ground, and there she is screaming, what's happening? And all I can think is, wow, you got a real hickey on your neck there.
She's also wearing this amazing 80s like tennis skirt and like a sweater around her shoulders, and it's just like the opposite of all the chaos, which I love. I never noticed that hickey before. I'll have to watch it again. I'm sure the Blu-ray makes it extra clear. Good for her. She was like, you know, I'm getting away from this. When there's a scene in the first one where she's like, I just have to get away from here. I have to leave. And then she does. And I was like, that's exactly what I do too. Leave the chaos, set boundaries.
Yeah, that is always, that is the thing that I always think when I watch that first movie is that, you know, bless her, Diane Freeling is just like, isn't this neat? And I'm thinking, no, it sure is not. Look at my kids sliding across the floor. Look at these chairs, like, climbing up themselves. Isn't that a hoot? No, it isn't. It's time to pick up and leave.
That's interesting. I've never thought about how I'd react. I mean, she was a product of the 70s where everyone was so into ESP and other dimensions and like positive spiritual forces. I could see how maybe she'd mistake it for just friendly spirits. But yeah, I think I'm pretty paranoid. I mean, I'm more afraid of neighbors than I am of ghosts. So I really don't know how I would react if that happened to me.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, full confession. I moved recently and my last neighbors were literally the worst neighbors of my whole life. And now, yes, I'm always nervous about neighbors, far, far more nervous about them pragmatically than I am about the possibility of my house being possessed. Mostly I'm just worried, like, do I have drunk neighbors who throw things around? That's way scarier. But yeah. I definitely like, but this is like another element that's sort of relevant as the series carried on into the sequel, because they set out in the first movie very pointedly that Jo Beth Williams, Diane Freeling, is still in sort of in touch with her younger self, still kind of feels like she's able to touch the beyond. She's got that part of herself. And Craig T. Nelson, who plays her husband, Stephen Freeling, is not that guy at all. You know, he still smokes weed when the kids aren't looking, but he's also reading, you know, books about Ronald Reagan and stuff, you know.
He wants that real estate money.
Yeah, like he is very much an 80s yuppie. And, you know, I think that Diane is kind of, she's pragmatically embraced it in certain ways. I always think in the first movie about how they find the dead bird. What is she? She says, Oh, shit. Couldn't you wait it till a school day? And there's something about that is, it's just very pragmatic, very like 80s yuppie response to death.
Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah, it's such a mom thing to say. You know, she has so much to deal with, like a dead bird. She just can't.
Yeah, she's just got enough of it. So all of these things sort of carry through in an interesting way. But I guess my question to you as an adult, looking at it, do you find yourself thinking, should they have made sequels to this movie? I mean, leaving aside the fact that it made a lot of money, like, do you really think it was a worthwhile endeavor? Like, if you could get in a time machine of your choice, would you be like, yeah, definitely do that? Or would you be like, guys, it's not worth it?
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, how to answer that question? I mean, I think that the original Poltergeist is a masterpiece. It stands completely on its own, and it's perfect. But I love, if I were, and so much of my love for these movies is marked by nostalgia, but yeah, I don't care. If I was going to go back just being the exact person who I am now, yeah, I would insist that they make both of the sequels. I can't imagine life without them. And part of that is because the Freelangs are such lovable characters that it's like you want them to just be on a sitcom forever where they get haunted every single week. And I know that they're not in part three, save for Carol Ann, which is a whole other story. And I could talk about those characters forever. And I have. but yeah, no, I think even though the sequels, they're very different from the first one and probably not as good, if there's some kind of objective kind of goodness, I can recognize it, even though I don't really feel that way. I need those sequels. Yeah, no, they're very important. What about you?
Oh, gosh, I don't know if I could say. The thing is that, they're somewhat intractable from my existence as a horror fan because the second one ruined my relationship with orthodontics forever. And also, the third one was something that was just on TV all of the time. And so even though I am aware that it's not good, there are certain elements, certain things that always stood out to me visually because it's that film is so surreal. Like walking down the hallway with the mirrors and like, you know, like someone opens the, like you see more than one image and it's like one at a time as you go down the line, like this person closes the door, then this person closes the door, then this person closes the door. And it's really unsettling. There are moments in Poltergeist 3 that really, I don't know, there's a lot that makes me jump, but there's a lot of stuff that I think was responsible for some childhood nightmares for me, to be sure. So yeah, I mean, I guess like I don't know what I would be like without those two. I think they both had a deep psychological impact on me, and in a way that makes me think like, man, I wish I could go back in time and be like, guys, for the sake of my teeth, could we just not make these movies? But then I probably would have seen like The Dentist or something, you know? I mean,
braces just are terrifying, you know, without any association.
Yeah, I think for sure. I think that I probably, to some degree, it would have been a problem. It just would have been a problem. So yeah, I guess I'll say regardless of the dental problems, you know. And you know what, Brian Yuzna, you can stay too. You made The Dentist, but you made Society also. So, and you made Return of the Living Dead Part 3. You all get to live. And I'm not gonna.
But the other thing I like about the sequels, even though in some ways Part 2 is such a ripoff of Part 1, but in some ways it's not. In some ways it's very, very different. The monsters are different. The things that are scary are very different. And Part 3 is totally different. And I really enjoy that. I really enjoy that each sequel takes a different approach. And they both kind of try to expand the mythology in very bizarre ways that in some ways tarnish the beautiful canon of the original. But it's still interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a choice. I will say this. Julian Beck. So, all right. So the pit. Let's just to pause very quickly. The sequel to Poltergeist is basically the Freelings are living someplace else, and the evil that was in the house in Cuesta Verde kind of still wants a piece of Heather O'Rourke, of Carol Ann. And it sort of takes the form of a more detailed explanation for why there were all of these bodies there, not just a happenstance, not just a burial ground, but that very specifically there was this sort of huckster, crazy preacher who convinced all of these people to come and hide in a cave because he's convinced that it's the end of the world, and when it's not, he doesn't let them leave, and he forces them all to die there. And so he becomes this deeply malevolent spirit that also has all of these other spirits that are with him, and with their power, he is sort of strong enough to manifest as himself and try to manipulate and destroy the Freelings from the inside out and take Carol Am as a means to, I forget what the ultimate goal is, but you know, it's something pretty sinister.
He just wants her to kind of prey on her life force and her vitality.
As you do. And so the actor that plays that preacher, whose name is Kane, is Julian Beck. And Julian Beck is, genuinely, just on sight, I want to call the cops immediately. He is a scary looking dude. Like, that's a guy that you're like, not safe. I'm not even saying like my kids aren't safe. I'm saying me personally, that skeleton with skin on, I am not safe around him. That guy has got superpowers, and I think that he can probably rip all of the muscle tissue from my bones in an instant just with a look. And that is sort of one thing that I will say. I kind of think that Poltergeist 2 has up on the other two. Like, he is so goddamn scary.
He really, I think I said to you when I emailed you, I think Poltergeist 2 is scarier than the original. I mean, it scared me as a kid. It still scares me now because of him. I mean, his face. I think he was one of the greatest performances ever in a horror movie, period. And he actually started an underground theater in the East Village that was very famous, I think, in the 50s and 60s. I think it was called the Living Theater. Don't quote me on that. Him and his wife, Judith Molina, which was very aggressive. It was about kind of confronting the audiences. So I think it was really a very creative and kind of bold decision to bring him in for this film, and a kind of, you know, the kind of creative move that Hollywood is not known for. And his face is just terrifying, and he just has this very threatening essence. I mean, there are flashbacks to the scenes underground in the cult when Diane has a psychic vision. Tangina wants her to remember who this guy is. And his face, it chills me to the bone. I think it actually scares me even more now because I've seen the power of cult-like leaders and what they can do to entire, like, American cultures.
I'm sure I don't know what you mean. No, I'm very very confused by what you've just said.
he's not to get too political, but he's just really, he's scary as fuck. Like, watching it a few days ago, I was like, holy shit. So I love him. He should have gotten an Oscar.
Yeah, that would have been, wow, that would have been something if that happened. But yeah, I mean, like, so it's that, and there's a couple layers. The sad thing is that, you know, Zelda Rubinstein is in it less. They kind of pull her out a little bit and replace her with Will Sampson, who plays Taylor, who's sort of like a medicine man almost. Sort of like they went out of their way to cast a Native American person for that, as I seem to recall.
Yeah, they were like going to reservations with a video camera and just like looking for people to audition for this movie.
Yeah, they were casting like it was 2018. They didn't want to get in trouble. So yeah, and he's sort of is a different kind of character, and I think that one thing I really like about this particular sequel is that it pitches up what is one of my favorite elements of the first movie, but that they only kind of hint at, which is that, you know, Carol Ann is not the only one. And you've already touched on this a little bit, that she's not the only one with sort of the gift, with that connection to whatever the other side is. And Diane Freeling really has got that too in a pretty potent way. You know, they suggest it in the first movie. They sort of talk about like her, like when she was a kid, kind of like sleepwalking and how she was sort of aware of certain things. And they create what I really like is a kind of a generational story of women. So, you know, it starts with Geraldine Fitzgerald, who comes in the sequel to play Diane's mother, Jess, and she's got it, and Diane's got it, and you know, and by proxy then also Carol Ann's got it. And so that's one of those things I feel like people often miss about both the first and the second Poltergeist movie, but especially the second, because I think it's a lot more pronounced, is that it is really in many ways about the a kind of maternal strength that you see, because a lot of the weakness in those films, in both, and especially again in the second, comes from Steven, comes from Craig T. Nelson's character, who is just not capable of dealing with this at all. You know, he winds up drinking a lot, and he winds up being far more susceptible to the dark forces than anybody else does.
It's interesting. I was noticing that watching it this time, that in the first movie, it's very much matriarchal. Like, all of the women in charge, from Beatrice Strait as the psychic investigator to Zelda Rubinstein to Jo Beth, it's just the women are doing everything. And in this, it's almost like Taylor has to come. Like, the executives were like, Steven has to get some agency in this one. Like, so Taylor has to come and, like, help him find his manhood. And Robbie, too. Like, these characters need to find their manhood in this film. Which, you know, I was like, nah, just leave it to the women. They're great. They're enough. But, no, it's a really great point. And I think it's one of the things that really drew me to the films, and probably one of the reasons that I love women and horror, because my first experience of the genre were these great, these multi-generations of phenomenal actresses playing these great characters.
It is interesting that in the sequel they do, and I wonder, because, like, I think some of the actors, Craig T. Nelson included, had really liked the script, and I wonder if they were like, finally, we get to do something. This is a little, like, you know, like, it's still, I do still think that the women are sort of largely in charge and have a sense of what's going on. But, you know, there is a real arc for Stephen Freeling in the sequel, in a way that there isn't as much in the original. Like, yeah, he's beleaguered. Yeah, he's got that whole bit with James Caan, which is, just one of those amazing, because whenever you bring James Caan into a movie, you can rely upon him to make an insane face, just a complete lunatic, like, we just moved the bodies, like, you didn't move them, did you? Like, it's just so, like, that stuff is good, but yeah, I just don't think Steve Freeling is, he's somewhat transformed, but, you know, like, Jo Beth Williams kind of steals the show. Like, it's really, it's her movie, it's Zelda's movie, and you brought up Beatrice Strait, and man, oh, she's in the first movie. Like, that's the only tragedy of the sequel to me. If I could make one change, just one, I would bring Dr. Lesh back, because Dr. Lesh is so good in that, such a like, all that stuff where, like, she brings the guys with her, you know, and, like, she knows that she's got to leave, and, you know, and she says, like, whatever it is, she goes, like, you know, like, we've got to go, you know, Marty is not coming back, but I am coming back. And it's, like, such a, oh, it's just chilling and wondrous. And, like, I think that is some of the wonder gets lost in the translation of the sequel, but I do think that, man, if they had just had Dr. Lesh, that would have cracked it.
She was supposed to be in the first scene where Tangina is at the side of the house. That was supposed to be Dr. Lesh. And I think for some reason, Beatrice Strait wouldn't sign on or whatever. And it was a tiny moment. But no, I mean, I love her in everything. And her monologue in the first one, where she talks about what the afterlife is, has permanently, I mean, that's what I think the afterlife is. Like, if I believe in an afterlife, it's what Beatrice Strait talked about in Poltergeist. And she really is. It has some amazing, moving scenes in that. But sorry, not to get back to the original too much. Let's get back to the sequel.
Yeah. So the sequel, go ahead. What are some things about it that really sort of jumped to you?
Well, kind of jumping off on what you said about Craig T. Nelson's journey, Steven's journey in this movie. I like, in the first movie, the family was so sort of idyllic, and their idyllic unity had to keep the demon, had to save Caroline. In this one, you know, Julian Beck or Kane kind of works at the unspoken tensions within this family. At one point, Steven says to Jo Beth, when he's possessed by Kane, you never wanted Caroline, she was an accident or whatever. And, you know, he's depressed because he doesn't have a job. He's a vacuum salesman. That's weighing on him. And the demons use this to kind of tear the family apart. And the family has to not just fight the demons, the other from outside, from the other world. They have to, you know, get over the shit within their family to fight them. And I really like that. What else jumps out at me? I'm one of the only people who Well, let me step back a minute. You know, H.R. Giger's monster work in this movie is tremendous, especially, of course, when Steven gets possessed by Kane. For some reason, he evicts Kane. He gets drunk on tequila, and there's a worm in it, which is Kane. And he gets it out of his system by throwing it up, and there's this crazy H.R. Giger vomit monster, which reminds me of my cat, actually, in a good way. But, but when I was a kid, it just really, really was like, whoa, that's amazing. I mean, so that blew me away. And, you know, I just remember that when I was a kid watching it, the thing that really I loved about the movie, and I saw Poltergeist 2 before I saw Poltergeist, which really affected the way I viewed Poltergeist, was just the idea that there was this kind of supernatural world that could exist within our own. You know, the movie does such a good job of creating, I mean, they look just like such a normal 80s family with a normal 80s life. It was so relatable. And then just that there were these other dimensions that they had access to all around them. It was fascinating to me, and it just made me want to kind of see any movie I could that showed the other possibilities of this world, which is not to say I believe in other spiritual dimensions. I don't know, but I found the idea very entrancing and appealing.
Rewatching it as an adult, I don't remember feeling one way or the other about Taylor as a character. Certainly, as in 2018, you go, is this offensive? Are we okay? Did we do this all right? Because, like, you know, it's definitely that time where we're thinking about those things. But I will say, as relates to Steve Freeling, I think the very presence of another man who's taking care of things is another way in which he starts feeling like he's losing control. And while Taylor is there to ostensibly help, he is accidentally in some ways kind of harmful. And Kane absolutely keys into that. You know, there's a whole sequence where he comes to the door and Carol Ann gets freaked out. So her and Diane go inside of the house and Steve stays outside to sort of talk to him. And Kane's, you know, very like, I'm glad that thus the two of us can talk now, and like just sort of lays the seeds, or like sort of helps to sort of like water and sow the seeds of resentment that that Steve is already feeling towards Taylor, I think is kind of a cool concept.
No, that is so true. I mean, first of all, the movie does a great job at showing the fragility of masculinity and how evil forces prey on that to create more evil and empower themselves. But yeah, watching it this time too, the first half, you know, when Steven's like, I have nothing against these people. I read Barry by Heart and Wounded Knee, and I was like, oh my God, I want to die. This is so terrible. How did I even recommend this to be discussed on the podcast? And then Diane also has that kind of weird scene where Taylor's putting war paint on Robbie, and she says, you know, you're not a mother and you don't understand. I want my kids to have a normal life. And I'm just like, oh, this is a little too like 80s white people for me. But the way that Kane uses Steven's fragile masculinity and maybe his fear of otherness as a force of evil, that's great. And that's ultimately, I think, a really kind of cool thing that the movie does. I agree with
that. Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but it really works. In hindsight, it actually makes it in some ways kind of a more effective watch now, because that's a topic of conversation that people have. I actually think it's better to watch it now maybe than when it first came out. But it was very successful. I think that's worth mentioning. It had like a huge blowout opening weekend. It did way better than the first one did in its opening weekend, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, 50% more box office. I always forget that. Like, I think this movie's a little bit forgotten now. And it never got great reviews, but it was kind of a monster hit.
Yeah, no, it made bonkers money. And yeah, I mean, I don't think I'm not sure there are that many people who would say hand on heart that they truly think it's better. I'm sure there are people who would say, like, I liked it more based on, you know, whether it's nostalgia or just, you know, preference based on story concept. But I think, you know, as objective as a thing can be, the first Poltergeist movie is, you know, capital A art, one of the most important horror movies ever made, I think. And Poltergeist 2 is a movie that you forget about and then rewatch and go, actually, This has got some, it's just less than the sum of its parts. Do you know what I mean? Like, there are these things that are great, like this sort of fragile masculinity thing that plays a little better now, and like the braces sequence, and like the weird worm sequence. All of those things are great, but like, there's just a lot of, it's one of those movies where honestly, like, there are just swaths of time where like you kind of want to hit the, that one fast forward button so that it's going at 1.5 times. Like, can we just get past this stuff a little bit? Like, you know, I was watching, for a different episode, I was watching all of the Wishmaster movies, and gosh, I don't want to surprise you, but I think at the very least, three and four, you the whole time you should be going 1.5 through, but you could probably do it on all four of those. And I would say there are parts of Poltergeist 2 where it's just like, this is boring. Like, it's just the whole beginning, like, is very aimless.
Yes, and it goes on forever, and I love it because I love the Freelings, but I will acknowledge that. And it also, it was a lot of editing was done in post production. So if you notice, there are continuity errors where Diane's wearing one sweater in one scene, then another one in the next scene, then the one from before in another scene. So I think they knew that there were problems with the pacing at the beginning, and but then when they re-edited it, it gives it a sort of weird fragmentary feeling. And like, there are a lot of different ideas and plot strands going on in this movie. And in some ways they don't really cohere. And I mean, God, the original, it's like poetry. It coheres so well. So yeah, I would definitely agree with you that Poltergeist 2 is kind of, it's like a bordering on Hot Mess a little, but in a way that I love. Whereas Poltergeist, it has like jagged edges that I think are effective. But yeah, Poltergeist is the masterpiece.
I wish I had watched 3 so that I would have a better memory of it. It's just, you know, it's completely different. It's just a completely different movie altogether. Like 2 is different, I suppose, but it still has, you know, the family element. The third one is
the suburbs.
Is Carol Ann is, yeah, the suburbs are gone. We're in this like weird like hotel kind of situation almost.
It's actually very similar to the skyscraper in Gremlins 2. She's living in this like city in a building. And I don't know why in the late 80s, early 90s, there was so much fascination around that. Diane and Steven like ditched her and sent her to live with her aunt and uncle, which after going to literally the other side twice to rescue her, I just don't imagine they would have done that. But, you know, contract issues. She's living with her art gallery owning feminist aunt and uncle, and her aunt can't really hack her. And Kane comes to find her in the building, and it's crazy. And if you have the Scream Factory Blu-ray of that, the audio commentary with the director, Gary Sherman, is amazing. Because I never realized it, but all of those mirror, there are lots of crazy mirror effects, and just all sorts of weird visuals. They were all done practically and edited in camera. And it blows your mind. Like, I listened to that audio commentary, and I was like, oh my God, this is one of the most mammoth achievements since fucking Lawrence of Arabia. Like, how did I ever know? So it's a really interesting movie in and of its own right. I always say it's very avant-garde. It reminds me of the early works of Maya Deren.
Wow, really pulling it out now.
Yeah, I'm trying to reclaim it. And it also has a lot of teen stuff. It's kind of like trying to ape on the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, which I enjoy too.
Oh, yeah. And what's kind of fun about that movie is that it there's this whole concept of like, who can you really trust? Who's been turned? That's a thing that really they never do in the previous films. You know, they don't really do that business where it's like, this one's been taken over, you know, like they do it with Steve the one time, and then they kind of compound it a little bit in part 3.
Yes, there's the excellent scene where the Lara Flynn Boyle's boyfriend rips her face off. You can never trust Lara Flynn Boyle. I mean, really, anyone who's seen The Temp should know that.
Yeah, no, I if I saw her walking down the street, I would cross to the other side and run.
I love her though forever.
Yeah, no, of course. But I think that's where the love comes from. Anyway, I would say so, like, other than Poltergeist 3, which I think, listen, my opinion is, if you go on for 2, you might as well watch 3. Once you're down that well, you know, just watch all 3 of them. I don't think there's any reason not to. But if we were to recommend a different film from a different franchise, perhaps, or a different standalone, what else should people watch based on an enjoyment of Poltergeist 2?
I would recommend an amazing haunted house movie, also about a family called Burnt Offerings from, I believe, 1975, with also some phenomenal women characters played by Karen Black and Bette Davis. And it's tonally, it's very different. I mean, you can really notice the difference between a 70s haunted house movie and an 80s haunted house movie. But it's very creepy and very well acted and just great. Have you ever seen it?
No, I've never actually seen that one. I mean, I've certainly heard of it.
Oh, I predict you'll love it. If you have any time for your Halloween viewing other than what you're doing for this show, I highly recommend giving it a spin.
Gosh, that almost makes me say that people should watch The Watcher in the Woods while we're on the Bette Davis tip. Like,
oh my God, well, that's the best. And that's another great little kid early 80s horror movie. That's a totally great. And that's another one you can, like, if you want to show your kids their first horror movies, sit them down for a double feature of The Watcher in the Woods and Poltergeist. They'll never be the same.
Yeah, 100%. I actually made a video some time ago. You should look it up on YouTube. If you type in like Sci-Fi Wire horror movies for kids, I believe both Poltergeist and Watcher in the Woods are on that list. As is the movie that I was originally going to say, which is not as good, but I still really like, which is The Gate.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually had that in my mind. That really captures that kind of 80s suburbia family friendly horror quality. It's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you can get over some of the unevenness of Poltergeist 2, then I think you can very easily get over the same kind of unevenness that takes place in The Gate, because The Gate also, again, is a little bit less than the sum of its parts. But man, when it hits, it really hits.
And also amazing 80s practical monster effects in that movie.
Oh, yeah, because they go from the micro to the macro in a really cool way, because there's little monsters and then there's like a really big version of those little monsters. And, you know, Stephen Dorff, little baby Stephen Dorff's in that one.
Isn't there a great woman in it? Like, isn't Martha Plimpton or somebody in it? Or did I just imagine that?
Who is in that? There's Kelly Rowan's in it. Jennifer Irwin's in it. Maybe it's somebody from The Gate 2. That one got a sequel. The Gate did get a sequel.
Don't you miss that? The early 90s where every movie got a made for video sequel that would be on Cinemax late at night. It was so beautiful.
It was great. Well, I used to, you know, to keep it on brand. Yeah, I used to watch Rhonda Shear on USA Up All Night.
Oh, yeah. She was the most profound influence. She and her movies that she showed in Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, were they have made me the person that I am today. I would give anything for Rhonda to come back a la Joe Bob Briggs and, you know.
Yeah, I'm always shocked that hasn't happened. Look that up. If you don't know who Rhonda Shear is and you're not familiar with USA Up All Night. I keep pitching to Jesse Murray, who is the person that sort of recommended you for this podcast. I always say, like, man, there's got to be a way to do this. Like, there's got to be a way to make it happen. Can we do this on Sci-Fi? Can we get her back? Can I be like a co-host? Can I like slide in? Can we get like Linnea Quigley and Michelle Bauer and bring Stevens to all like come and make appearances and like get all of like these old VHS Scream Queens to pop in? Like, I would, you know, if I could be, you know, like be a fly on the wall even, but, you know, involved in any way, that might be my dream. I think that, like, there was, I won't say who it was, but at one point, Jesse, I think it tried to pitch getting a particular famous drag queen to come in and do like a Rhonda Shear kind of thing for us at one point, and it never materialized, which is a shame, because that's exactly my idea of what I want out of a thing. And I could totally see somebody like that, like, yeah, doing like The Gate 2, Poltergeist 2, you know, like every weird Mary Lou, Prom Night 2. Like, it's funny that this particular podcast has grabbed so many sequels. So many people have come with sequels rather than originals.
That's interesting. I'm glad for that. I wonder why. It must just be because coincidentally they worm their way into people's hearts.
Yeah, I think anything that finds its way onto TV more than, you know, because you're much more likely to see Poltergeist 2 and 3 on TV than you were the original. You know, it's like how many Eddie Murphy movies can I say that I've seen over 100 times? Actually, not that many, but The Golden Child? Yes, most certainly.
Yes. And I guess the studios probably gave those away for cheaper. Like, you could always watch The Exorcist 2 or Halloween 2. on TV, and you never ever saw the originals.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for talking about this fine movie with me. Do you want to sort of like just give a quick pitch on the Eli Roth thing that you've been working on?
Yes, that was the total dream project for me. It's a 7-episode documentary series on the history of the horror film. It's called AMC Visionaries, Eli Roth's History of Horror. I think it's the longest documentary on the horror genre, the longest documentary covering the whole history of the horror genre ever made. So it's going to be on October 14th, Sunday night at midnight, but you'll also be able to stream it on the AMC app and I believe iTunes and Amazon if you don't want to stay up that late on Sunday, but I hope that you will. We got a lot of amazing stars and it's really, really a fun show. I'm really proud of it.
Do you have a social media presence if someone wanted to follow you on like a Twitter or Instagram or something?
Yeah, I'm Eyes of Ben Schur on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And I'm more active on Instagram and Facebook than I am on Twitter. I'm very old school in that way, I guess.
Well, I mean, you know, Instagram is the, I think that's more modern than Twitter. I'll say that. Yeah, that's more what the kids are up to than anything else. Anyway, thank you. People can find me, Danny Roth, on sci-fi.com, where you can listen to more episodes of this podcast, Everyday Horror, along with a whole host, a family, a hub, if you will, of Sci-Fi Wire podcasts. And you can watch videos like the one that I mentioned about horror movies for kids, and we do all kinds of videos of that type, and all my stuff is there. And if you want to follow me on Twitter and Instagram, you can find me there at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary also with one N. Thank you for listening, and remember, sometimes the best cure for the horrors of every day is a little everyday horror. We'll see you next time.